You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, the Human Rights Campaign declared what they call a state of emergency for LGBTQ people living in the United States. Their first ever emergency declaration comes after more than 75 anti-LGBTQ plus bills were signed into law this year in states around the country. This all came after same-sex marriage was legalized nationwide back in 2015. Our next guest is a historian who says there's a long history of progress followed by pushback in rights and acceptance in the U.S. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How does today's level of understanding and acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer identities compare to your memories of past years or past decades, for that matter? If you identify as queer, how has people's treatment of you changed over time or maybe different places around the country? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Hugh Ryan is a New York-based writer, historian, and curator specializing in queer history. Hugh, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on, and happy Pride.
Thank you. Well, I want to dig into the history in just a minute, but I wanted to get your thoughts on the current state. In 2023, a lot of laws being passed around the country, threats to Pride events, disruptions at drag queen story hours, the list goes on and on. Are you feeling particularly pessimistic about this spot in history?
You know, I wouldn't necessarily say pessimistic, but I would say we're in a bad moment. I think that there is a lot happening right now that has been unprecedented in sort of the mainstream of American politics for the last few years. I mean, we're not that far off, as your intro mentioned, from this legalization of same-sex marriage. So it's not like we had some halcyon before that we are now sliding away from. But certainly these attacks, particularly on trans folks and trans youth, are incredibly concerning, very dangerous. And I think, likely, unfortunately, to get worse before things get better.
You wrote recently at Slate, among other places, about this being kind of a norm in the United States. Some progress, then pushback and backsliding, sometimes dangerous backsliding. How common has this pattern been over history?
You know, I think with almost any issue that you look at, there is this pattern of wrestling almost with it, you know, this contestation. Things move forward and move backward because the metrics that we have to judge progress on issues are things like, was this law passed or repealed, right? But that law doesn't measure every person in the country, and even its passage or repeal doesn't index how every single person feels about it. So just because one law passes doesn't mean we've changed every mind or that every time that that law is referenced, it will be held up in the way that it should be. So I think what we actually see over and over again is lots of folks who are on one side, lots of folks who are another, sort of pushing back and forth and trying to get the mainstream to consider these issues from their point of view. So anytime that we get progress on something like trans rights, you know, we had that transgender tipping point in the media back in, 2014, 2015, you get that kind of progress, then you still have all of those people out there who are incredibly transphobic or who are really conservative over gender generally. I mean, I think it's not a coincidence that we're seeing this pushback against trans people's bodily autonomy. At the same time, we're seeing this pushback against cis women's bodily autonomy with the overturning of Dobbs, you know, and the attacks on abortion rights around this country.
I want to dig into that history a little bit now. And in that Slate piece I mentioned, you start off in the 1800s here in the United States, where we didn't necessarily even have categories like heterosexual, homosexual, as we talked about people. Could you give us that as a starting point?
Ooh, yeah. Okay. You're bringing me to my happy place, the Victorian era, but it does mean that I've got a lot of history to get through. So I'm going to try to do this like quickly, but also comprehensively. So where I think we're at right now has this real parallel at the end of the 19th century. As you mentioned, in the 1800s, we had an idea of what it meant to be queer. And when I use that word, I just mean sexually non-normative. It's a broad category. I'm not trying to evoke a specific identity like gay or lesbian, you know? So there was this idea of what it meant to be queer in America in the 1800s, and it rested largely on gender. Right? It was how well you acted like a Victorian man or a proper Victorian woman. And who you had sex with was part of that, but only a small part. There were many people having sex with many other people who were not considered queer, as still happens today. but it was really about your gender and how well you performed your gender. And of course, this makes sense, right? The Victorian world, men are expected to spend all their time with men. Women are expected to spend all their time with women. Abraham Lincoln shared a bed with his best male friend for 4 years with little commentary, right? In that world, people who we today would think of as cis normative gay people were kind of invisible. But people that we today would think of as trans or intersex were hyper visible because they were expected, again, to be spending all of their time with people of the same sex. So this was the category America understood as queer for most of the 1800s. It had a lot of different names, but towards the end of the 1800s, sexologists labeled it inversion, or being an invert. And it was assumed that if you were an invert, you were not only different in your gender, but in your very body. There was no disconnect between personality and the body the way we have today. Psychology and Freud hadn't come along and moved all of this stuff into our minds. And instead, it was thought that if you had thin lips, for instance, you were probably dishonest. And if your gender presentation was off from the norm, then your body was considered different too. So we've got this third sex category. That's our starting place in the 1800s. But then this thing happens that nobody expected to have any change on queer identity, but it did. And that thing was urbanization. Over the course of the 1800s, America goes from being a country where about 8% of people live in cities to one where about 40% of people live in cities. And in these new American cities, those Victorian rules separating men and women started to break down. On the subway, on the waterfront, in Coney Island, in places like dance halls and saloons, in all of these crowded spaces, in women's colleges, and all of this, people started to find each other, people who we today, again, would call normative, cisgendered homosexuals. They began to see each other in these cities and realize they had something in common. And that thing that they had in common wasn't their gender. It was the thing that we now today call sexuality, right? So because of urbanization, new people found each other and began to name this common identity that they shared. And then a whole bunch of doctors noticed them doing that, as did lawyers and activists and moralists. And we get this building over the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th of our modern categories of queer identity. Lesbians, gays, bisexuals, transgender, intersex, all of this arises from this moment where cities allowed queer people to see each other in greater numbers and define ourselves relative to one another. And then all these doctors said, okay, these divisions matter and we're going to put a name on them. This is a homosexual. This is a heterosexual. Heterosexuality in the late 1900s and even in the early or late 1800s and even the early 1900s in America didn't mean what we mean it as today. It was considered a diseased state, a morbid attraction to the same sex, right? All of this had to get defined in order for us to even think politically about the rights of a gay person. We had to be able to imagine the existence of a gay person. So this happens at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And almost immediately afterwards, we get the first laws in this country criminalizing homosexuality.
Talking to historian Hugh Ryan about progress and pushback in lesbian, gay, queer rights in general in the United States. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. And Hugh, I wanted to pick up there. You mentioned laws start being, we have these categories now, and laws start being passed, regulating, forbidding, prohibiting. What kind of things do you see? How quickly does this spread?
It spreads pretty quickly, but I mean, it takes a while for people to move into these cities, have these ideas, but we start by the 1920s to get laws banning solicitation between men, right? Laws banning women wearing pants, laws banning all of these other kinds of activities. And then we get mental health categories being written, you know, that these are diseased states. And we get all of these things about, you know, banning homosexuals from the military in World War I and World War II, right? There's this rapid spread of all of these places where homosexuals are now seen as villains, as threats to security, as failures of development, and as inherently criminal people who will disorder everyone around them. That's a big thing. Disorderly conduct. This idea that just having a gay person in public or in a bar or in a school would pervert the world around them, would be a social contagion, to use the language of today. We see that in the 19-teens, in the 1920s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, 90s, and it's right back around again. But I think something big happens at the end of the 1900s. When I was a young person in the 80s and 90s, particularly the 90s, we start to get this new revolution in ideas of queerness in America. So if urbanization at the end of the 19th century allowed all of these people to see each other, at the end of the 20th century, the same thing happens again, only this time it happens thanks to the internet. And it's totally different than last time. New communities are able to see each other on the internet and define themselves around their experience of gender and sexuality, the things we call personality and identity, right? So that's why we see this rise in categories of identification for being trans or being bisexual or being asexual. All of these things that the sort of straight doctors and gatekeepers at the end of the 1800s didn't bother to name because they didn't see them as real, or they didn't think they mattered, or enough people weren't able to find each other for them to be defined. Well, the internet suddenly allows that at the end of the 20th century. And we are now, 30 years later, having that same backlash that we saw from the end of the 19th century to the beginning of the 20th century. There is a change in meaning that is happening right now, which is above and beyond the normal tussle and back and forth over progressive versus conservative ideas, which we see at all times. There's something more, to use a really like hoity-toity word, epistemic. Our understanding is changing, not just about what's right or wrong, but what's natural and possible and real. I mean, so much of the pushback you see right now of young people, Gen Z and Gen Alpha, is that their identities aren't real. They're made up. They're just a phase. All the things that, you know, I heard as a gay person in the 80s, we see it come right back around again.
We're talking to queer historian Hugh Ryan about the current state of LGBTQ rights and progress and pushback over American history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have your opinions and understanding of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or new identities changed over time? Do you remember a time when public understanding was much, much different? And if we're talking about your actual life experience, love to hear from you. What are you seeing in schools, the workplace, your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Hugh Ryan, an LGBTQ historian, about past cycles of progress and pushback and what they can tell us about what's going on now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like your community is safe and welcoming toward LGBTQ people? Do you see debates maybe in your own local school? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. On a local station, sometimes people call in for discussions and they'll say, God made man and made woman, and those are immutable. Well, I don't understand how they could figure many chromosomes have variations, whether it's eye color or whatever. So why would X chromosomes and Y chromosomes be exactly alike in every person?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Dennis bringing up both, biological and theological definitions of men and women, Hugh. And I assume we've talked about those in different ways over the years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, science is constantly evolving, and what we understand about gender, sexuality, genetics, environment, nature, personality, it's constantly changing, which is why at the end of the day, for me, I often return to I don't really care about biology very much. I think that we live beyond biology all the time. Either everything we do is natural or nothing we do is natural. And by the same reasoning, if you believe in an all-powerful monotheistic God, either everything we do is part of God's plan or none of it is, right? I think that these things, they're places to get our heads wrapped around and ways often to excuse pre-existing things that we feel uncomfortable with or ideas that we already have. But at the end of the day, what you do with your body, so long as it's not hurting someone else, is your business. Bodily autonomy and freedom are the things that I care about. Care is the thing I care about, how we take care of each other, regardless of whether we agree about our religious values or our ideas of what is natural.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. We'll go to Will now in Platteville. Will, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share that for me, growing up in the 80s and 90s, didn't really have a term to describe myself very well, other than maybe androgynous or just, you know, not very manly. And it was in the 2000s, and I learned the term genderqueer from a friend. And later on, that term has kind of shifted more towards non-binary. But that wasn't a thing, a category I even knew back then. And how the language and, like you're talking about with the internet, these new categorizations of self-description and kind of the freedom it gave me once I kind of fell into realizing that that's kind of what described me best.
Yeah, well, what was it like for you to say, hey, here's a term that kind of sums up how I think about myself that I didn't have before?
It was nice in that I could just say, okay, here's the term. You can go look it up. But then at the same time, it didn't change a whole lot other than kind of validating that there's other people with this experience and that, you know, now I can point to something and say, hey, it's not just some quirk of myself, that this is a shared experience with others.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. Hugh, what do you think?
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Will. I mean, I think this is so important. The categories that we have, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, they were written mostly by straight people who weren't interested in our experiences, the kind of experience you're talking about, Will. And they were written about what straight people could easily observe from us from the outside. They're not about how we experience our gender or our attractions. And that's what's happening right now, is friends talking to friends, queer folks talking to other queer folks, and getting to learn and create a language for our experiences that doesn't have to do with something as simple as a binary sexual object choice. Are you sleeping with a man or sleeping with a woman? That's not about experience, right? That's about action. We're concerned about identity, how we feel, how we want to be understood. And that's what labels help us with. You know, it's like labels for political parties. Knowing that you're a Democrat or a Republican doesn't tell me everything about you. It doesn't even tell me everything about how you vote, but it gives me a sense of who you are, what you think about, where you place yourself in the world. And that's what this expanded language for identity that we're creating, co-creating right now gives us. And I'm really excited to see people experiencing that in my lifetime, in my generation, getting to watch people be able to define themselves in ways that feel more comfortable, closer to their experience, and are better able to communicate what they feel and think with the rest of the world.
Well, thanks for that call.
It's kind of beautiful.
Thanks for that call, Will. Talking to Hugh Ryan, a historian, about progress and pushback on LGBTQ rights over the decades in the United States. Back to your calls. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Yeah, hi. Recently in the news, there were some massive parades, and en masse, they were chanting, we're here, we're queer, and we're coming for your children. And when there was some objection to that sentiment, they said, well, it was just a joke. And I'm wondering what your guest thinks is funny about that.
Jim,
and
thanks for the...
I also want to point out that nobody really cares what consenting adults do with each other, but they are objecting to children having irreversible surgery done.
Gotcha. Jim, thanks for the call. Now, for the chant, there was a New York drag group with a different chant. One voice is heard with that, we're coming for your children. Is that something you followed, Hugh?
You know, I heard about that. I mean, I think it's one of those things that gets cherry picked up on the internet. You know, a single person or six people making a joke somewhere gets reverberated around to be a big idea that many people are promoting across many marches. I mean, we heard that in the comment just now. It's never specific, right? It's never pinned to an actual moment. It's always this generalized fear of something that's often a joke or isn't even real when you dig into it. As for this idea that people are only concerned about children, well, first off, most gender-affirming procedures that are performed on children are actually performed on cis children to make them fit our standards of what it means to be properly gendered or sexed. So if people were really concerned about that, I think we'd be seeing a much broader pushback against surgery on children in general. And right now, there are people who are pushing to overturn same-sex marriage. And in fact, although it's being thrown out in courts around the country, they are trying to restrict the access of adults to gender-affirming care and treatment to make it impossible to get insurance for it so that you can be pursued by Child Protective Services for doing it. I mean, I think it's it's sort of laughable to say that people aren't coming for adults. I think what we do see, and what was evident in that call, is that the idea of this perfect cisgendered white child being harmed is always used as an attack on queer people and minorities in general, right? I think that this idea that one cisgendered child might someday have experienced gender care that they then change their mind on abnegates the experiences of all of the trans children and the gender nonconforming children who need this care, right? If this was really about children, I think we'd be talking about all of the children, not just trying to protect the one they have in the head, their heads that reminds them of themselves.
Thanks for that call. And just our last half a minute or so, Hugh, is there a particular issue or type of law that you have your eyes on at this moment in history?
Oh, gosh. I mean, far too many of them. But I think these trans bans and the way that they are using children, the idea of children, it throws me right back to Anita Bryant in the 70s with the Save Our Children campaign and conservatives in the 80s and 90s who were advocating tattooing the HIV status on anyone who was positive to prevent transmission, right? We look at these issues where there are serious things to wonder about, right? Like, I have a lot of trans friends who would love some long-term studies on hormones, but instead of actually thinking about the people who are being harmed, we imagine this child who might potentially be harmed, and therefore we must inflict this incredible cruelty onto groups that we have historically been cruel to already, right? It's over and over again, this child as a wedge issue, because it's so hard to push back and say, you know, that of course we should be concerned about children. But I think that it's being used in bad faith, and it's only a very specific kind of child that they care about.
Hugh, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob. And thanks to everybody who's listening. I'm easy to find on the internet. Please continue this conversation. I'm so excited to see this happening around the country right now during Pride. So thanks for having me on.
That's Hugh Ryan, a writer, historian, author of the books When Brooklyn Was Queer and The Women's House of Detention, with us for a look at ups and downs and progress and pushback on LGBTQ issues in the United States. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Senator Tammy Baldwin tells us about the $1 billion+ in federal funding Wisconsin is set to receive to improve access to high-speed internet connections. First, Wagner mercenary group Yevgeny Prigozhin is now living in exile after an apparent attempted mutiny against Russia's military. This comes as American officials say at least one Russian general knew ahead of time about the rebellion plans. That general hasn't been seen publicly for close to a week. All this comes as Ukrainian forces are in the midst of their planned counteroffensive aimed at retaking eastern parts of the country. We're talking now about what just happened, what we do and don't know, and what it all means for the continued Russian occupation of parts of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this weekend's events and what they mean? Were you following this in real time? And like many people, were you confused by what happened, what came out of it? What would you like to know about the attempted apparent mutiny? And what role, if any, should the U.S. play in supporting Ukrainian resistance against the Russian military? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mikhail Troyetsky is a professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison. Mikhail, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good afternoon, everyone.
Can you talk about, first of all, the unique role of this Wagner military mercenary group, but obviously closely affiliated with Russia? Can you give us a little of their history?
Well, I think the background to mention here is that the Wagner group was created some 10 years ago to give Russia deniability in its operations in eastern Ukraine during the initial stage of the invasion, when Russian forces helped two Ukrainian provinces de facto secede from Ukraine. And President Putin wanted deniability. He didn't want to accept Russia or its military was there in eastern Ukraine. So I think that was when the idea came up of establishing a private military company. But later on, as time went by, I think the Russian government figured out that it was quite useful. The PMC was quite useful in kind of shadow operations in other places as well, primarily Central and Northern Africa, where, again, Russia could stay under the radar as a country and yet have its military that de facto reported to the Russian general staff just, you know, conduct operations, maybe prop up some local regimes or anti-regime forces, depending on who the Russian government wanted to win in the manifold conflicts in Africa. So that was how the Wagner Group came into prominence. And as the fighting in Ukraine was raging after the February 2022 invasion, Wagner also turned out to be in demand given the problems faced by the Russian military. So the ruthless but still very well-trained fighters were found quite useful, again, as a supporting force for the Russian uniformed military during their war in Ukraine.
Now, here we are last weekend. The leader of this military mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, criticizes more than he had before the Russian military, criticized the grounds for the invasion, the full invasion of Ukraine, turns his troops down the highway toward Moscow, then stops. Now, there's a lot of speculation. Mal, what do we know about what what led to that? What do we know for sure about his motivations in doing this?
Well, I think we have enough evidence to perhaps suggest that the Kremlin and President Vladimir Putin personally was growing unhappy with Prigozhin and the Wagner Group as this maverick force that was getting public traction. And with Prigozhin coming up with all those statements blaming the Russian top commanders for failing to support his very effective men in their assault in a, you know, in a Ukrainian city that apparently Putin wanted to seize. So Prigozhin's public prominence was kind of unpleasant to Putin and the Kremlin. So they decided to deal with him somehow, marginalize him, and then perhaps also destroy him and part of his fighters physically. So at that point, I think Prigozhin, who likely was tipped off about that plot by the Kremlin, decided to just to rebel. He had little, if anything, to lose. And apparently he also enjoyed support and at the very least sympathies among some Russian military commanders, including high-ranking generals, and he also was getting traction among the rank and file military, among the soldiers fighting on the battlefront. And so he just went ahead and seized a major Russian city in the south, out of which much of Russia's campaign, military campaign in Ukraine, is being run. And then he staged a march on Moscow, aborting it at some point, being quite close to Moscow when it became clear that his mercenaries will most likely have to fight their way into Moscow. And apparently, amid some defections or dissatisfaction among his men, who didn't want to just, you know, fight against Putin's forces. That wasn't their agenda. That wasn't their platform. And then as long as Putin himself and his associates were afraid of what could happen, Prigozhin proved able to bail himself out of that situation and was allowed to escape unscathed to Belarus, whose president offered him asylum. And apparently some other Wagner commanders and maybe even troops are with Prigozhin in Belarus right now. That is as much as we know. We also hear from the US media that some of the generals that are being suspected of sympathizing and maybe even abetting Prigozhin's mutiny have been followed up with and have been apparently interrogated, maybe even kept in custody. So there's some kind of a purge or at least a reckoning going on in Moscow and elsewhere among the Russian military and more broadly the state apparatus in the aftermath of that coup that apparently proved quite divisive for the military and also the Russian bureaucracy.
We're talking about the events in Russia last week, the uprising by the Wagner mercenary group quickly dissipated. Mikhail Troitsky is with us, Russia expert at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. If you're wondering what happened next with this mutiny in the aftermath, wider thoughts on the U.S. role supporting Ukraine against the invasion, call 800-642-1234. Mikhail, a lot of people have pointed out that, okay, we have this armed revolt for a little while. We didn't see Russian people rising up in support of it. Also didn't see Russian people particularly rising up in support of Putin in the face of what he said was effectively an emergency, the risk of civil war. What do you make of the non-public response from the Russian public here?
Well, I think Prigozhin may have counted on broader public support and enthusiasm and some political momentum that this show of public support could have generated. But in Russia these days, apparently the majority of the population kind of is sitting on the fence. They do not fiercely support Russia's war effort in Ukraine, but neither are they excited about Russia just retreating, acknowledging defeat, pulling out of Ukraine. So those people like Prigozhin as someone who probably just made a difference. He went on the record complaining about the problems with the Russian military. And apparently many people think that the Russian military has been underperforming in Ukraine. So Prigozhin was kind of giving the system a shake. And he also was and is a very apt public relations figure. So he actually went on a tour, on a PR tour around Russia, making his case in front of audiences in a number of major Russian cities. So he was getting public traction, which kind of explains some of the display of public support, especially in the city of Rostov that Wagner forces captured early in the mutiny. But otherwise, no one in Moscow, for example, was getting out in the streets, you know, preparing to cheer Wagner troops as they would be entering the city. And of course, Prigozhin is a very controversial figure for many people, especially Moscow residents. Prigozhin is a ruthless warlord whose forces committed many documented you know, war crimes and atrocities. So that kind of figure was, you know, would inevitably be very divisive and controversial for the Russians, even those who think that Putin is either underperforming in the war against Ukraine or has run his course as Russia's president and has to go because he's, you know, a dictator, undemocratic, is waging a criminal war, and so forth. So Prigozhin, he and whatever political ideas he kind of was hinting at were not sufficient, apparently, to rally support for him among the Russian public and apparently also the military on whose defections he could have probably been counting.
Let's bring on a caller. Jeff is with us in Dubuque. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And my question involves military tactics. When the Wagner Group headed up towards Moscow, would that not have been an opportunity to grant them a temporary ceasefire, enabling them to leave their positions in Ukraine to join that group as they're heading towards Moscow and to be filled by the Ukrainians?
Interesting question, Jeff. Now, Mikhail, as I understand it, after the fighting in Bakhmut, the Wagner Group mostly had withdrawn from the front lines to be replaced by Russian soldiers. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think so. The Wagner Group had to pull out. Well, they actually volunteered to pull out. They announced their withdrawal from the front lines, and they were based in some field camps around the city of Rostov and also in the Ukrainian territories that Russia annexed since the start of the war. So they were apparently no longer involved in the fighting at the time of the mutiny, which basically freed up their hands to just make a raid on Rostov and then head towards Moscow.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Interesting question. Mikhail Troitsky is with us, professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison. We're looking at the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, including the apparent mutiny that stalled last weekend and what happens after. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the latest news in that war? Do you have thoughts on American support for Ukraine? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Mikhail Troitsky, professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison, looking at the attempted mutiny in Russia by mercenary forces there, the ensuing fallout, and in general, the latest status of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. That's 800-642-1234. Mikhail, a big question now is, does this mutiny in any way weaken Russia's military in its ongoing efforts in Ukraine, or are the troops on the front line not looking over their shoulders at what's going on here? It might be a while before we have a real answer to that question. What are you watching for?
Yeah, I think clearly the Bortiv mutiny highlighted at least some divisions within the Russian military. And I believe also state bureaucracy, high-ranking officials, some of whom may well have been wishing Prigozhin well and the success in his coup attempt. We also saw President Putin just delivering one brief address, short of fiery rhetoric, just, you know, kind of condemnation, a moderate condemnation of Prigozhin and his forces. So he apparently was afraid of going all in, maybe hedging some of his bets. And eventually, as we saw, the coup ended with some kind of a compromise, not with a destruction of Wagner and Prigozhin, which may have been planned before the coup started, actually triggering that coup attempt. That said, of course, the Russian military are likely operating pretty much autonomously from the politics that is going on in Moscow and Russia in general. So the commanders are still there, and you know, the whole organization of the troops and their tactics and their plans may have not been affected. That said, again, the questions with respect to the decisions that were being made and the resolve that the Russian government has to persist in that war have indeed come into question as a result of that coup.
We heard from Bobby in Madison, who wonders if the Belarusian president is allies with Putin, why would he let Prigozhin and, as you said, officers and maybe troops come into Belarus. What do we know about the Belarusian leaders' angle on this?
Well, I think for Putin and the Kremlin, it was the best bet to actually have give Prigozhin an off-ramp. And if you are Putin, and if you think about what kind of off-ramp may be available, you immediately think about your ally, Lukashenko in Belarus, and you just ask him if he would be amenable to a solution whereby he gives temporary asylum to Prigozhin and some of his mercenary commanders so that you can deal with them later in Belarus or elsewhere. And, you know, Lukashenko is happy to oblige. This does not pose major threats to his rule in Belarus, and maybe even gives him some leeway if he is able to, you know, to just make good friends with those troops. He may later on use the mercenaries in certain situations whenever his, you know, grip on power is threatened, for example. So that could look like a good opportunity for Lukashenko as well. This is how I see it. But again, you know, too many balls are in the air, and we really don't know now how it's going to play out. Too many moving parts.
I mean, I wanted to ask about American and Western European support from Ukraine. We've seen a steady leveling up of the kinds of weaponry supplied, from handheld items to more and more larger and more sophisticated piece of equipment. Now reports that the U.S. is looking at granting longer-range missiles than we were willing to in the past. Just your thoughts on the significance of that material support for the Ukrainian military.
Well, at least the Ukrainian side has long been suggesting that this longer-range artillery could be key to its efforts, you know, at a counteroffensive against the Russian forces. And it might well be true as long as Ukraine may be able to strike Crimea from the current Ukrainian positions, and, you know, destabilize the situation in Crimea for the Russians, that would be a very big deal. So on the U.S. side, I think the takeaway from this abortive coup was that there just may be too many divisions within the Russian military. And there are some elements among the Russian military that may support ending the war, and that may be amenable to either negotiation or perhaps even a new coup that could, you know, destabilize this whole war effort. And in any case, you know, Moscow may not even have the guts to retaliate at this point. And that, of course, may have influenced this decision, or not yet a decision, but at least an advanced discussion of potential supplies of those shells, of those long-range artillery shells to Ukraine by the U.S.
Mikhail, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
Mikhail Troyetsky is a professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at the latest developments in the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine, including this apparent mutiny over the weekend by Russian mercenary troops. Beginning on July 1st, that's this Saturday, listeners to WPR at 90.9 FM in the Madison area, well, you'll want to set your radios to 90.5 FM to hear the Ideas Network. 90.9 FM is going to stop broadcasting, be replaced by a more powerful signal at 90.5. That station is going to carry the same content, but serve a larger area for listeners in South Central Wisconsin. Thanks for adjusting your radios to help WPR reach and serve more listeners in this part of the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.